Earlier this month, activists released video of alleged animal abuse at a dairy farm in Indiana. Now the Chicago Tribune is looking into who actually makes sure animals are treated humanely. Plus, a Chicago investment firm recently bought Whataburger, one of Texas' most beloved fast food chains. And not surprisingly, Texans are not happy. And all this week, we're bringing you some reading recommendations for the summer. Today, we're starting off with fiction.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boudou. Coming up this hour, after beating France, the U.S. women's team is now two wins away from its fourth World Cup. We'll bring you a preview of tomorrow's semifinal match. Plus, we're going to bring you some fiction book recommendations for your summer reading with writers from all across Illinois. But first, last month, an undercover investigator with the animal welfare group Animal Recovery Mission released footage of disturbing treatment of dairy calves at an Indiana farm called Fair Oaks, about an hour east of Kankakee. The graphic video of cows and newborn calves being punched, kicked, and dragged by workers has led to public apologies from farm owners, animal cruelty charges being filed against three employees, and many retailers pulling the milk it supplied, that's Fairlife milk, from its shelves. So who was monitoring the treatment of these animals? That question was originally posed by Chicago Tribune reporter Alexia Elejalde Ruiz, and she's on the line from Chicago now with what she found. Hi, Alexia. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi there.
Jamie Junker is also with us from Washington, D.C., where he's Vice President of Sustainability and Scientific Affairs for the National Milk Producers Federation. Hi, Jamie. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Nyla.
Alexa, I wonder if we can just start with what's happened since that video came to light. I talked about some things, but can you fill us in on all the details?
Yeah, so the videos were released in early June, and pretty much immediately the owners of Fair Oaks Farms, came out with a statement apologizing for it, expressing horror and devastation at what the footage revealed, and identifying the workers, so they'd identified the workers who were involved, that they had been fired, those that were employed by the farm. The prosecutor in Newton County investigated, filed charges against three workers, one of whom has been arrested since. I'm not sure what the state of the other status of the other's workers are at this point. And basically, the farm has pledged a bunch of reforms to its practices, promising to install cameras to ensure that it is keeping an eye on all the cows at all times and making the live feed of those cameras available to the public on its dairy tours, to school groups and whatever, so that people can see what's going on. Fairlife milk, as you mentioned, was pulled from some retailers' shelves. It's a really popular brand, so this is pretty damaging to their image, and they have also pledged to conduct audits of all of its supplying farms and increase oversight over its animal welfare practices. Coca-Cola is investigating, so everybody, responded pretty immediately when they realized how outraged the public had become.
And Alexia, before this incident, I wonder if you can share with us what laws, are there laws that exist in Illinois for the treatment of particularly for dairy animals? What is that process supposed to look like?
So what I learned when I asked the question was that there's no, government body proactively, overseeing the treatment of farm animals. So usually what typically happens is if somebody spots abuse or is concerned about it, they'll reach out to authorities, and the USDA's has a division that will investigate, and if they find something to be with merit, they'll try to correct the have the farmer comply with laws, and if that's not happening, they might refer it to the prosecutor's office, who can then press charges. The only law that covers farm animals is the same law that covers cruelty to dogs and cats. So, you know, farm animals cannot be tortured or abused or starved, just like any other animals can't. But there's not specific laws governing the treatment of farm animals. There is an industry oversight practice, which I'm sure Jamie can talk about as well.
And Jamie, that's what you help run. That's an industry oversight that's called FARM, Farmers Assuring Responsible Management.
Yes, that's correct, Nyla. And the FARM program has been put together to develop standards for animal care for the 37,000 licensed dairy farms in all 50 states in the U.S.
And what kind of regulations or self-regulations do you guys have in place?
So with our standards, we have standards requiring veterinary involvement, training of employees. We have requirements for what we call a herd health plan. Think about that as kind of like the medical protocol for keeping animals healthy, and if they get sick, how you deal with sick animals. We also do what we call second-party evaluations, where we have trained and certified evaluators that go out on individual dairy farms once every 3 years to see how they are conforming to the standards. And with certain standards like the veterinary oversight and the employee training, if they're not meeting those standards, they're put on what's called a mandatory corrective action plan. And if they're unable to complete that mandatory corrective action plan, they can actually be suspended from the program.
And this is a voluntary program, though, right, Jamie?
It is a voluntary program. We do have about 98% of the U.S. Dairy farms and milk supply enrolled in the program. I think it's become an expectation from our dairy customers, restaurants, retailers, and such, that whether it's our program or a different program, that a dairy farm is in some sort of animal care program.
So, Jamie, I wonder what your reaction was when you saw the video, or the videos, I guess I should say.
So we have a process within the farm program called our willful mistreatment protocol, and whether we get allegations coming from an undercover video or we get allegations coming from within the industry itself through professionals like veterinarians, nutritionists, and sometimes even other dairy farmers, we go through the same process. We do a determination to see if the allegations are credible, and if they're credible, we initiate a third-party audit to review the farm. In this case, Fair Oaks Farms is going through our willful mistreatment protocol.
And so you all had, did you all receive the video, correct, before it was released? So you were already investigating?
So in early June, we had received notification from the farm that an undercover video was going to be released about that farm. And on that same day is when ARM released the video.
Okay. And so then you have it sounded like you said you have a third party now that's investigating everything now as well, in addition to everything else Alexia mentioned?
Yes, that's correct. We contract with a third party called Food Safety Net Services to do a very focused audit on a farm when there's allegations of abuse or neglect. And they've gone through that process at Fair Oaks Farms. They are now on probation with the farm program. If they are able to successfully complete all the corrective actions required, they are then back in good standing. If they do not complete the corrective actions required, they are then suspended from the program. And that would be the case for any farm that goes through this willful mistreatment protocol, whether it's from an undercover video or it's from allegations from someone else.
Jamie, I wonder, I mean, you work for the National Milk Producers Federation. I imagine, as Alexia was talking about, this video was, I imagine, pretty damaging to the brand, to thinking about trust people have in milk producers across the country, right?
So any time that you have credible allegations of abuse, certainly there can be, I think, potential damage to brands, whether it's, you know, a brand of an individual company, or if it's more what I'll call the dairy brand of general dairy products in general. But what we've tried to do with the farm program is have a process to determine if the allegations are true. If they are, then have a process to see about having the farm go through a redemption process. And if they are able to complete that, we bring them back into the full parts of the farm program.
That's Jamie Jonker with the National Milk Producers Federation. We've been talking to him about the process that they use, an organization that's called FARM. It's Farmers Assuring Responsible Management. Of course, all of this has come to light because of the treatment of some footage we saw of treatment of dairy calves at an Indiana farm called Fair Oaks. They were a supplier to Fair Life Milk. Alexia Elizalde Ruiz has been reporting on this. And one of the other folks that she featured in her reporting was Tim Joseph, someone else from the dairy industry. He's the founding farmer of the Maple Hill Milk brand. Their corporate headquarters are actually here in Deerfield, although they work with 160 small family-owned farms in upstate New York. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So, Tim, you've been in the dairy industry for 15 years. Is that correct?
Roughly, yeah.
And so when these allegations, when this video came out about Fair Oaks Farms, I wonder what your first thoughts were, what your reaction was.
I mean, obviously, it was a horrifying set of videos to watch, and you know, really didn't do. I thought it doesn't do dairy any favors, and it really was just a brutal set of videos. And given, you know, sort of our different take on many things in terms of, you know, production and all of that, it just was so far from anything that we would ever hope to see. It was really just a wake-up call, I think, for brands and consumers to just keep wondering where their food is coming from. And so it was quite shocking.
And when you say your different take on things, how is it different for Maple Hill Farms, Tim?
Well, we're 100% grass-fed, certified organic. That's our foundation, and that's what we were founded on, which is just a completely different production system. When you see cows on grass, maximize grazing, we've got farms keeping calves on cows, or at least, you know, calves in groups. It's just a whole different system. And, interestingly, you know, the plant-based milk movement and the grass-fed dairy movement are both tied to one thing when you talk to consumers, and that's animal welfare. And that consumers have, those that are informed, and there's more every day because of things like this, when they start looking at how food is produced or where it comes from, they're more comfortable with the idea of, you know, cows grazing outside all the time, not on concrete, in a more natural system, and that actually is the big driver behind grass-fed and the growth of Maple Hill is, an animal welfare focus, as well as, you know, health benefits and all of that. But the big one is animal welfare. So,
Tim, can I ask you something? So when you said the calves on cows, what do you mean, that the calves are actually milking with their mothers? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, for many years, we've you know, found that the ultimate, you know, cow comes from, you know, calves all turn into cows, right? The female calves turn into future cows. And that when you keep a calf on a cow as much as you can from birth, the resulting, you know, heifer and cow later is just so healthy. The herd is so much healthier over time. And so we've got, you know, I think about 25 or 30% of our farms are venturing into developing systems and management protocols to keep the calf with the cow for at least part of the day. And that seems to keep both of them happier. The calf, of course, is just amazingly healthy. Now, I want to be clear, it's not possible for every farm, right? This is something that we're just trying to improve things where we can, as best we can. And it's a tough job for farmers who are already under immense pressure. And that goes for all dairy farmers in the whole industry. And so, you know, it's a big jump and a big risk, and obviously they do lose milk, but more and more of our farmers are figuring out ways to do it and how to do things differently.
Tim, I want to ask you a question, and Jamie, I'd love to have you weigh in afterwards. Tim, do you think that regardless of how you're choosing to raise your animals, it seems like right now what we've learned is that the dairy industry is primarily self-regulating. Tim, do you have a problem with that? Would you prefer that there were state or federal regulations around this?
No, I really wouldn't. Farms, and you know, I'm obviously talking about dairy here, are so diverse and so varied in their geography, where they do things, how they do things, that I don't think, government coming in and telling, we all know you shouldn't, abuse calves and cows. It was such an egregious example. In the end, I believe that it's the responsibility of brands. And the onus is on brands, because obviously when something like this happens, the financial impact to a brand can be disastrous. And any brand that doesn't, wake up to that fact is asleep at the wheel. I believe that in the end, consumers are the ones who choose, how things are done. And when things like this happen, and God forbid they happen again, they will choose alternates based upon it. And if we as the dairy industry don't wake up to that fact and make sure that if we're self-regulating, that we're doing it in as robust and thorough a fashion as we can. And I'm not saying that's not happening. There's always going to be exceptions and bad actors. And really, in the end, the ones who determine what happens to those bad actors are the consumers who vote with their dollars, right?
Mm,
and that's,
yeah.
I just have a fundamental belief that is the most effective long-term way to do it, that takes into account all the various systems that are out there, conventional, organic, grass-fed, who knows what the next is, right? And it's about consumers looking deeper into where their food is coming from and making choices based upon that they think meet their values.
Tim Joseph is the founding farmer of one of the founding farmers with Maple Hill. Thank you for taking the time to be with us. Jamie, I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to go back to you. Jamie Jonker with the National Milk Producers Federation. We will tweet out Alexia Elahalde Ruiz's reporting on this if you want to know more about what this looks like in Illinois. All of you, thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're hoping you have some downtime this summer to catch up on reading. This week on the program, we're going to be offering you some book recommendations. Who better to give us their picks than three writers? Later this week, we're going to be talking nonfiction and young adult and children's book, but today we're starting with fiction. Joining us is Nina Barrett, author of The Leopold and Loeb Files, owner of Bookend and Beginnings, an independent bookstore in Evanston. Also joining us is Amy Hassinger, author of three novels. Her most recent is After the Dam. She teaches creative writing at the U of I. Nafisa Thompson-Spires is also with me here in studio. She's a professor of creative writing also at the University of Illinois. Her book, The Heads of Colored People, made the long list for the National Book Award last year. Nina, Amy, Nafisa, thank you for being with me. Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
And for all of you listening, you can join the conversation by texting your book recommendations to 217-394-5765. Again, that's 217-394-5765. Nina, can I start by asking, when the weather starts getting warmer, which I know has been very slow to come to Evanston this year, what kind of book recommendations are people coming into Bookends and Beginnings looking for? Something different than the spring?
Well, I mean, summer reading, people are looking for some entertainment. We do have a clientele that's been reading, I think, some fairly heavy political stuff. In the summer, maybe you're looking for a little bit of escapism. I feel like the kind of summer reading that we tend to recommend, it's fun, but it's a little more on the snack food side. But I think in the summer, it's sort of better to eat a ripe peach than a bag of Doritos. So we're recommending some things that have great plot. And in my case, there's a lot of great local writing that we're recommending, either, you know, by a Chicago or Evanston or Illinois writer, or that's on a Chicago or Illinois theme.
Okay. So, Amy, I wonder what you're reading right now.
Well, I actually just finished reading my colleague Nafisa's book, Heads of the Colored People. Nafisa, I finished it last night, and I just adored it. It's a book that's getting a great deal of attention, and it's all really well-deserved, and I highly recommend it. I mean, Nafisa's here, so she could talk about it herself.
She could. Amy,
I can say,
well, oh, go ahead. Why did you want to read it, Amy?
Well, I mean, obviously, since I know Nafisa primarily, and I'd heard so many great things about the book, but one of the things that I really admire about the book is that it illuminates contemporary, you know, many of the characters are contemporary Black middle class people, many of them women. And it's, the way that Nafisa looks at her material is both really funny, just compulsively readable, but also profoundly serious. And there were a couple of stories in particular that really touched me. I think in particular, the last one, which is about a woman named Alma, who is deeply affected by the violence that she confronts with her patients. She's a nurse, as well as a singer who sings at funerals. And this so disturbs her, the way she sees, you know, many children, African-American children who are the victims of police brutality. And she has a young child, an 18-month-old boy herself. And she's so disturbed by what she sees that it, I don't want to give away the story, but it really profoundly affects the relationship with her son.
Right.
So
okay.
So
well, thanks
gems.
For that. Yeah. So Amy's recommending, actually, Nafisa's great, Heads of the Colored People. Nafisa, so it's a collection of stories, which I wonder, actually, when you're writing in that genre, which is like a collection of short stories rather than a full length novel, is that something that you actually think is even better for the summer if people are traveling a lot? Or you probably didn't even think about that when you were writing it, right?
I didn't think about it, but I chose two short story collections. And I think that first comment about bite-sized sort of snackable text is interesting, that for the summer, I think people are looking for beach reads and kind of vacation reads, and that maybe shorter stories might have some appeal for that reason.
And so one of your recommendations, Nafisa, was We Cast a Shadow by Maurice Ruffin. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's actually a novel that I'm super excited about. Maurice Ruffin has gotten a lot of great press for it. It's about a Black man whose son is put through a very experimental program that basically depigments him. So he's learning what it would be like for this biracial son, I should add, to grow up with the option of becoming white. So it's kind of a...
This is like a future...
It's satirical,
right,
for sure.
Okay.
But I really like Maurice's voice so far. I like that he's doing the kind of work of like a Colson Whitehead or a Paul Beatty. Lots of funny social commentary, but also really dark content.
Okay, that's We Cast a Shadow by Maurice Ruffin. Nina, let's get to some of your recommendations. I've got five here, but why don't you pick which one you want to start by sharing us about? Which
sure.
One?
Well, I had, actually, there are several really good historical novels, and here we're going to go from short to very long, I'm going to say, but people may be familiar with Rosellen Brown, who is what she's really famous for was a novel called Before and After that came out about 2 decades ago, was made into a movie. She hasn't published anything for about 20 years, but she published something called The Lake on Fire, which is a historical novel set in Chicago, late 19th century, around the time of the Columbian Exposition. And it follows what happens to a Jewish woman who her family has emigrated to America. They're a Jewish family that they're coming to be part of a utopian farm commune in America. But the problem is none of them have ever farmed before, and they get to America and the farm is a complete disaster. And the main character, Chaya, is worried that they're going to marry her off to some yokel. And so she runs away to Chicago, and she tries to make it on her own. And if you think about what it would be like to be a woman alone in Chicago in the late 19th century, when there are a lot of, you know, strictures on what kinds of jobs you can do and you know, what is good moral behavior. So it's a complicated story. It starts to veer into being a Cinderella story because she meets a sort of rich, handsome man. But it doesn't want to be a Cinderella story because it sort of knows better than that. And so the complications that ensue are also really interesting. It's just really richly written. It reads like a 19th century novel by George Eliot or Henry James.
Wow. So that's Rosalind Brown, The Lake on Fire. There's another 19th century Chicago novel you recommended, Jonathan Carr's Make Me a City, Nina?
Yeah, and that's been very under the radar. And I think that's because he's a European author who apparently only lived in Chicago very briefly, but he very ambitiously tells the whole, what he sort of poses it as an alternative history of Chicago from the beginning of the 19th century when there's literally one house in Chicago to the end of the 19th century when Chicago is a world, you know, presence and certainly an American industrial presence. And again, the Columbian Exposition is going on. But he does it in this really creative, inventive way where each chapter is in a sort of different genre. So it might be somebody's diary entry, or it might be a fake historical document, or it might be like an Irish immigrant narrating something in Irish dialect. And as you move forward chronologically through the century, the stories, you find out that the characters who are narrating each story have some kind of linkage. Mm. He puts in a lot of the characters that have gotten left out of the story of Chicago. So there's a whole Native American dimension and a whole African American dimension. And, you know, the poor people who got crushed by the, you know, powerful people who were just trying to make a buck. It's sort of all in there.
So that's Make Me a City by Jonathan Carr. We're talking summer fiction book recommendations with Nina Barrett. You were just listening to her. She's the owner of Bookends and Beginnings, an independent bookstore in Evanston. Amy Hassinger is also the author of three novels and teaches creative writing at the U of I, along with her other U of I creative writing colleague, Nafisa Thompson Spires. Amy, what's another one that you had on your the top of your list for a pick for this summer?
Well, one of the ones I was thinking about, it, to go back to this idea of kind of bite-sized fictions, if you want super bite-sized, I would highly recommend Lydia Davis. This is, I'm thinking of her collection, Varieties of Disturbance. It's not a super new collection. I think it came out maybe in 2007. But I read it with my graduate students this year and just adored it. And one of the things about Lydia Davis that's so wonderful is that she writes these, as I said, very super short fictions, many of them, not all of them, some of them are actually quite long, and she has just kind of a sparkling wit. So one of her stories, I mean, some of them are so short, I'm going to read you one right now. This one is called Tropical Storm. Like a tropical storm, I too may one day become better organized. That's the story.
Oh, okay.
You can dip in, you know, imagine.
I mean, that's very short, right? Sort of, that's not even a train ride, but. Okay. So that's Varieties of Disturbance by Lydia Davis. Thanks for that. So, Nafisa, you came in here with three books, and one of them was Lot by Brian Washington. Can you tell me about that one?
Yes, this is the one I'm the most excited about. It's a short story collection by a debut writer. He's 25, I think.
Wow.
He already has another novel under contract. It's a YA novel, I think, about coming of age and coming out. But this collection has been getting so much press, and it's really well-deserved. The first two stories are amazing. They're the only two I've read so far, so I can't speak to the other content yet. But I'm super excited. There's kind of a wry voice like Juno Diaz in his early days. The stories are connected. There's a narrator in Lot. All the stories are set in Houston, who recurs in several stories. And he's dealing with his sexuality, his family. He's a biracial Black man who's also Latinx. And this Houston community kind of becomes the characters in the collection. And so my favorite story so far is the second one, which is called A Leaf, and it's set in a Houston neighborhood, kind of a housing development where a woman's lover is killed right in front of the whole neighborhood on their lawn. And it's sort of piecing together in a kind of retelling of A Rose for Emily, William Faulkner's story, which is one of my favorites, how this murder happened and why, but with a really wry, funny voice.
And so I read something that this was an instant classic of Texas literature, and I was wondering what you meant by that, especially when we think about, I think what people might think of Texas literature might be different now, especially when we look at how much the changing demographics of a city like Houston look like right now than it did before.
And honestly, have looked like for a long time, if we're being honest. I think what Brian Washington's doing is revealing a lot of these stories that have been true for a lot of Texans, but maybe not the representation of Texas that we tend to see in the mainstream. So it's not the white, cowboy boot-wearing Republican Texan. We're seeing a lot of black and brown people, a lot of Latinx people, a lot of black people who are dealing with poverty, class issues, but also sexuality issues, and in really funny, interesting ways.
Nafisa, what else did you, can we go through, I think we have time for one more from you. Which one do you want to pick?
Other, I'm going to represent for short stories today, but one of my other faves right now is Home Remedies by Jean Juliana Wong. And this is a collection of stories by another debut writer who is a Stegner Fellow. And the stories deal with neighborhoods, again, in some interesting ways. A lot of them are set in Chinatown, and they're dealing with kind of generational Chinese-American issues. The first story, which I loved so much, has a kind of whimsical take on an overpopulation of carp that are also overgrown. So they're these giant carp who are overpopulating this Chinatown body of water. And it parallels what's happening with the old Chinatown population. The humans are actually leaving as well, and the Chinese immigrants are doing a kind of reverse migration back to China. And the story is a great commentary on the way we treat immigrants. And actually all three of the books I chose are kind of good commentaries on immigration and very timely.
So that's Home Remedies. She also mentioned Lot and We Cast a Shadow. Don't worry, we are going to have all of this up at our website. We know we've mentioned a lot of books here. We will have lists that we are compiling. Nina, what else did you want to highlight?
Well, I think I'd have to mention Courting Mr. Lincoln, which is, of course, set in Springfield and is about Abraham Lincoln's courtship with Mary Todd. And two things that we know about that are that it mysteriously broke off for quite some time and then resumed. And we also sort of famously know now that Lincoln was living in a boarding house where he was sharing a bed with a man named Joshua Speed. And there's been a lot of speculation about what that relationship was. And in Courting Mr. Lincoln, it's a really sort of tenderly, compassionately done novel about all three of them and sort of probing the idea that maybe it was Joshua Speed and Abraham Lincoln's relationship that had this kind of gravitational pull on what was going on between Lincoln and Mary Todd. It really beautifully evokes Springfield at the time. You get really involved with these characters. It doesn't push anything too hard. So I just think in terms of looking at the very many facets of Lincoln that there are, this is a really new, interesting kind of contribution to the Lincoln literature.
And this is obviously a fiction account of...
It's a novel, yeah.
Right. So it's a novel about three real-life people, Abraham Lincoln, mm-hmm. Joshua Speed, and Mary Todd Lincoln, then.
Right.
Okay. Amy, what about you? I think we have time for one more.
Sure. I think I'll highlight a book called Gold Fame Citrus by Claire Vey Watkins. I had the pleasure of hearing Claire read the first chapter of this novel earlier this summer and wanted to read it myself immediately. So I've only just begun it. I actually haven't read it yet, but it's a story that's set in kind of a near future California, a California that's been devastated by climate change. So the wildfires have and, severe drought have completely transformed the landscape. And we're following the character of a woman named Luce Dunn, who is a grown-up young woman who was formerly known as Baby Dunn because she was adopted by the Bureau of Conservation as kind of a poster child for their cause. And she and her lover, Ray, are squatting in this abandoned mansion because much of, Southern California has been abandoned and evacuated by this point and kind of trying to survive. And Luce spends her time trying on the dresses of this former, the starlet who formerly owned the mansion.
Yeah, so climate fiction is still, I imagine, a really popular genre this summer. And so that's Gold Fame Citrus by Claire Vey Watkins. We've got a list of all of these. We didn't get a chance to get to all of Nina, Amy, and Nafisa's selections. They each picked five, but we're going to have them all up at our website at 21stshow.org. All of you, thank you for taking the time to be with me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Morgan. Good run here by Tobin Heath. Possibilities here for the USA. And should be 2-0 and is. What a World Cup for Megan Rapinoe. She sweeps the ball past a helpless Sara Bouhanni. France 0, USA 2.
That's John Helm calling last Thursday's World Cup quarterfinal for FIFA TV. The U.S. women's team beat France. The final score was 2-1 and moves on to the semifinal against England. That match is tomorrow at 2 p.m. Central. The U.S. has made it to at least a semifinal in each of the eight women's World Cups. They've won three of them, now shooting for their fourth. France was considered the biggest threat to Team USA. So what does the rest of the path to victory look like? Bailey Burmaster is a reporter with WBAY in Green Bay, Wisconsin. She's also a former soccer player herself for Oklahoma State. And she's on the line now. Hi, Bailey. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be a part of it.
So, Bailey, so much of the conversation coming in was about how this USA versus France match felt more like a final, not just a quarterfinal. Did it feel like that to you watching it?
I think so, just for the mere fact that it's the host city. France is a competitive team, so there was a lot on the line. And both of these teams were favorite to win the World Cup, and the U.S. came out on top. I think it was very similar, but in a sense that, you know, like you said, it was, you know, the final before the final, I guess you could say. But U.S. came out on top, which is kind of what I predicted. And you could see offensively, they were a little better team, even though they didn't have their best day.
Right. And so, and I think even if you're not an avid soccer fan, one name that lots of people are getting used to hearing is Megan Rapinoe. So she scored five goals so far this World Cup, including two in that match on Friday against France. What is it about her that she's really kind of emerged as the star of the team? Can we talk about her style of play a little bit?
Yeah, we can. I think something that Rapinoe does really, really well in that outside forward position is she drives the end line, and she's able to get these amazing crosses across the box, which, you know, a lot of times, especially when you see men play the game, they might try and chip it into the box. But for her, she drives it hard, low, and that's exactly what you want. And it has ended up for the U.S. a lot of goals in the back of the net. She's just a very hard player to defend, in a sense that she's so skillful. She's very quick and she's a very smart player. But I think something that maybe the world is seeing a little bit more of which is part of her game, is her confidence. Mm-hmm. I think you can see it in her eyes that there's not a player she's taking on that she's saying, oh, I may not be able to get past them. No, she knows she's going to get past them, and she's hopefully going to end up with a goal at the end of it. And I think that confidence and leadership she has is really infectious for the entire team.
And so as we're looking at the U.S. team, obviously, as you're talking about her offense, that's been really important. What about how the U.S. has been doing defending?
Defending-wise, I think they've done really well. I think there were a lot of questions going into France as to whether this defense was ready, because they hadn't really been challenged, so to speak. But Dunn at the outside position, I think, totally stepped up. It wasn't necessarily the prettiest game, but she was able to really shut down some of France's top strikers and really showed out. So I think defensively, they've proven their worth a little bit more. But I think maybe the biggest question mark for this USA team is goalkeeping. Neher, what people think about her and how she does her job. It's very different than what we're used to seeing with Hope Solo.
Right. And she was, I think, a really visible player in the team as well. So we've talked about U.S. and France were considered the two best teams. Now France is out. So we face England tomorrow. How serious a threat are the English team?
They're very serious. I think you could put just as much weight on them as you put on France. I mean, they have some really great players. Striker Ellen White is also up for the Golden Boot. She's just a really sharp, aggressive player, especially in the penalty area when she gets in that box. And you have to remember, this is a team that the U.S. Women's National Team has played 16 times against, and they're 10-4-2. And the big stat you want to pay attention to is they've only won one of the last three games against them. So it's going to be a hard game. I mean, at this point, there's no easy game, but I still like the U.S. as a better team.
Okay, Bailey, so for people who have maybe just jumped on this bandwagon, people who do not have the benefit that you have of having played soccer yourself, what should they be watching for in tomorrow's game?
Definitely just go through the progression of the game. So for starters, you want to see what the lineup is. Early on in the World Cup, the U.S. was switching their lineup a lot, which is a little unusual, but that's what Ellis wanted to do with just getting players more minutes, seeing what worked. I assume it will look a lot like it will with France. Obviously, Megan Rapinoe is someone you want to watch. She can't miss her with the purple hair. The way she plays the game is really extraordinary, and she's so fun to watch. Obviously, you have maybe a U.S. favorite, Alex Morgan, who's been honestly struggling a little bit in this World Cup, so it will be interesting to see if she can get something going against England. I also really like Julie Ertz. I think she brings an aggressiveness in the midfield that's really necessary in this game. And then defensively, just see how they hold up against another really great opponent.
So, Bailey, the first Women's World Cup was actually in 1991, and since then the U.S. women's team has been in at least the semifinals every time. This team has been really good for a long time. Do you feel like this World Cup, they're maybe getting different attention than they have in the past? Maybe finally the attention they deserve?
I 110% agree with that, because I think it's just the progression of where our world is going and the awareness that the team has brought to the situation of maybe comparisons between the U.S. women's national team and the U.S. men's national team. Not to mention, it's sad that it's taken this long, but people, viewers from the United States, like winners. And when you're winning, it's hard not to pay attention. And that's something this team has done over and over, is win and win. And it's like, now they're finally like, okay. But the sad thing about it is you're still getting the storylines of, are they arrogant? Are they overly confident? Which you rarely see anyone say that about.
Yeah, no one says that about a men's team, right?
No,
well, and then there's also the storyline about pay, right? Bailey, I just wanted to ask you about that. When you, one analysis by The Guardian found that the World Cup bonuses women earn would be six times greater if they were men, and that's comparing just the U.S. a men's team to the women's team. And I know in March, players filed a federal lawsuit against U.S. soccer. How is that being a part of this conversation as well?
It's huge, and I think that's kind of like, they may not be speaking a lot on it right now, but their play speaks for itself, and I think it's a really important aspect to look at. I understand the argument of men's soccer in general around the world is more profitable than women's professional soccer. I get that, but when you want to break down the U.S. women's national team to the U.S. men's national team, point blank, the women's team is better. They consistently make the World Cup. The men can't even do that. Yet, if you look at the numbers from that Guardian article, it's pretty staggering. It's really sad that it's like this, but I think we're headed in the right direction, so to speak, for what the women's national team is doing, how they're shining light on it, and, you know, speaking that it's not okay. And they're better than the men's team, yet they're not getting paid.
That's Bailey Burmaster. She's a reporter with WBAY in Green Bay, Wisconsin, a former college soccer player. Bailey, thank you for taking the time to be with us. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
If there's one thing Texans love talking about, it's their state and the pride they have for it. So it was big news in Texas when its beloved burger chain, Whataburger, announced they had sold a majority of their company shares to a Chicago-based investment firm.
What a development. Those orange and white stripes that are arguably as Texas as Longhorns and Bluebonnets are changing hands.
San Antonio's Whataburger has a new owner this evening.
Some fans are saying, what are you thinking?
That was audio from Texas news stations KVU and Austin, KTVT in Dallas. Clearly, Texans are a bit worried about their iconic burger chain's possible expansion under a new ownership with an Illinois company. They're pretty mad at us. We figured you probably hadn't even heard about this. So here to tell us more is Dan Solomon, a culture writer for Texas Monthly Magazine in Austin. Hi, Dan. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dan, so wait, first you have to clear up for us. Is it Whataburger or Whataburger?
The name of the chain is Whataburger, but the Texas accent tends to come out as Whataburger.
Ah, okay. So it's really Whataburger. Well, okay, that's a hard one. All right, we'll just leave it at that. So how would you describe Texans' love for this hamburger chain?
It's pretty deep. It's a part of the cultural identity here. It's, you know, it's kind of a King of the Hill sort of thing. Like, it just became something that people in Texas really claim as ours. And we, you know, we love to have things that are ours. We love to have things that say this is from Texas and we claim it and it belongs to us and we belong to it. So seeing Whataburger get sold was a blow to that identity.
And what is the favorites on this? Is this kind of like an In-N-Out thing where it's basically like a hamburger chain, but because it's a local one, everybody loves it? Like, what is it about Whataburger that everybody likes?
There's two answers. One is, yes, this is very much an In-N-Out thing where it's just a local, you know, statewide, but it's a thing that we believe belongs to us and thus it must be better than everywhere else. Also, they have spicy ketchup and honey butter chicken biscuits, which are delicious.
Oh, that's – well, yeah, both of those sound very delicious. So I know that Whataburger put out a statement after the sale saying, quote, Texas, we don't want you to be upset. We will always be Texan and represent you in a way that makes you proud. Are people in Texas concerned that this burger chain is now going to be majority owned by a Chicago company that owns, among other things, Lou Malnati's?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's all very silly, of course. We're talking about a burger chain here. But, you know, because people have invested a lot of emotional energy in Whataburger, and it's definitely true that they do. People get married at Whataburger. People, you know, children have their birthday parties at Whataburger. It's a thing that really does matter to people. And it matters, you know, not because the burgers are the absolute best burgers you'll get anywhere. It's a fast food burger. It's a good one, but it's still just a fast food burger.
It's just a brand people love, right? So would it be,
exactly.
So you grew up in the Chicagoland area, Dan. So what is our Illinois equivalent? Is it Portillo's? Is it pizza? Like, well, pizza could be controversial because people might fight over Lou Malnati's or Giornato's or another one of those.
I think that it's probably more like maybe Vienna beef hot dogs.
Okay. Yeah.
Something along those lines, something that, you know, it's ultimately not that different from the competing brand, but it's a little better. And more than that, it's something that you get here and it you know, it tells you that you're home.
Okay, so one last question. What's the worst Chicago food item that could be incorporated into a Whataburger menu, or at least one that would be the most shocking for Texans?
I think that people would have a really hard time. You know, deep dish pizza doesn't do that well
that would be gross.
In Texas,
yeah.
Generally.
Right.
And I think that it would be a strange combination for Whataburger.
All right. Well, Dan, thanks for telling us a little bit more about Whataburger. Culture writer at Texas Monthly Magazine. He wrote a great piece about this. We'll tweet it out. Thank you for taking the time, Dan. I appreciate it.
Sure thing.
Before we go today, I have something that I need to share with all of you listening. This month will be my last one hosting the 21st. It was a hard decision for me to leave this program. I'm very proud of what I have created here, and I want everyone to know that it's been an incredible honor to host this program. But this fall, I'm going to be headed to the University of Michigan to be a Knight Wallace Journalism Fellow. And the 21st, of course, will continue. All of the staff, the names you hear me say all the time, they aren't going anywhere, and a national search is underway for my replacement. In the meantime, we still have a month together. I would love to hear from you about any suggestions you have for topics or people you want me to cover or talk about on the 21st before I go. Is there something maybe you've been meaning to suggest to me, but you haven't gotten around to it? Well, now is the time to do it. You can email us. Our email's talk@21stshow.org. You can message us on Facebook or on Twitter or leave us a voicemail. I do really mean that. I want to hear from you. I'd love to have the last week of me being on air, all things that you guys want me to talk about. So get in touch. You can always go to 21stshow.org. were produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Alpasan and Jasper Davidoff are our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. As I mentioned, all those links, every other way to contact us, if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook, leave us a voicemail, send us an email, just go to 21stshow.org. That's also where we've got all of our past shows archived. You can also find us most places you get your podcasts. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. I'll see you back here tomorrow. I'm Nyla Boodoo.